This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Dr. Daryl Lismore. How are you, Dr. Daryl?
I'm great, thanks, Chris.
What do I call you, Dr. Daryl?
Just Daryl's.
Daryl's.
Yeah, please.
Nice. Last week we were talking about all the different ways you can fiddle around with the genetics and the traits in a grape variety and play with them and see what you can do and try and get new things that might be useful. This week, I want to look at some of the work that you're actually doing here in Lincoln. We're here in Lincoln, in just outside of Christchurch, and you've got a brand new sequencer, a British sequencer.
That's right, from Oxford Nanopore Technologies.
What's it called?
It's called the Promethean.
Promethean, isn't that a Greek boat or something?
Big monster or something, I guess.
I think it was something from Aliens. Wasn't there something from
Aliens? That's right, there's an Aliens movie along the lines of Prometheus, that's what it was.
That's right. But what we want to talk about today is the work you guys are doing in terms of trying to develop clones of Sauvignon Blanc that might have traits that you're looking for. So before we get into that, do you want to just give us a bit of a history about what it is and where it's at?
Sure. So this program is fairly young. In fact, all grapevine improvement in New Zealand is fairly young, just like our industry is. And the industry has frequently identified that one of its major risks is a lack of genetic diversity. We don't have any native grapevines. All we have is the vines that were imported and have been planted here. And that set of diversity has, in some cases, been lost. Only a certain subset of the world's global genetic diversity in grapevines, a tiny subset, was brought here. Some of it has been lost over time, and it's very hard to bring in new material because of our biosecurity requirements. And so this project was aimed at tackling part of that challenge of new genetic diversity. Without diversity, there's no option for improvement. There's nothing to select from. It's specifically focused at new genetic diversity that is still Sauvignon Blanc, because 85% of what we sell is Sauvignon Blanc. It's such a premium market signal. A lot of our industry's interest has been, how do we produce something that addresses some of our priority traits, like higher productivity, new flavors and aromas, resilience to disease, but is still Sauvignon Blanc, and hence clonal selection.
Yeah, and also with climate change, things like, I think you mentioned last week, things like bud burst might become quite important.
Absolutely.
And issues like that as well. So there is some traits that you might want to improve on for the New Zealand situation.
That's right.
But there's also traits you don't want to lose, like that vibrancy of flavour and the acidity and all that type of thing as well. So how long has the project been running and when did it start?
So the project has developed out of work that started in 2009 at Lincoln University, to understand what causes clonal diversity and can we change the rate at which these natural changes happen. That was when I was doing a PhD in Dr. Chris Weinfield's group. After that, we started to partner with Plant and Food Research, who are also here in Lincoln, and did a proof of concept first in Chardonnay and then in Pinot Noir to show that we could produce new clones of diversity. And then when New Zealand wine growers set up the Brugato Research Institute, I joined them, and the goal was to try and produce a useful level of diversity in Sauvignon Blanc, our premium varietal that we grow. And so since 2021, really, the program has been aimed at producing new clonal diversity in Sauvignon Blanc. It runs till April 2030, and it's aimed at producing first the subset of diversity so that we have a collection, and then at starting to identify useful improvements in some of the priority traits within that collection.
Okay, what's the method you're using to do this?
Yeah, so technically it is mutagenesis. We do it from individual cells called somatic embryos. So they are embryos, cells that can grow into whole new plants, but they're somatic because they come from vegetative tissue. They're not from the seed, that we don't use pollen or anything like that. We basically take a process called tissue culture, which is where you are propagating a small amount of the plant in a sterile environment. The sterility is just to keep it going and provide all the nutrients it needs. And then you rejuvenate whole plants from that.
So you take a bit of plant material, extract a subset of that can then grow into a new plant, and then you twist it up a little bit.
The first bit, getting some cells that are rapidly dividing, but are not whole plants. They're basically stem cells. These are, the technical term is totipotent. It means they can become any new type of tissue. And by plants determine which type of tissue they grow through their hormones. And so if you apply a certain type of hormone, plants start to grow leaves. If you apply another hormone, they grow roots. But if you apply a balanced combination of both, they do neither. They don't differentiate, they just multiply their cells and they maintain this tissue that can become anything. So that's the first step, is producing this stuff. And it's similar to how you do virus elimination. You grow a small amount of tissue and then you recover whole plants from that. But if you can do that, it gives you the opportunity to expose those cells to a stress event which causes random mutations, and then recover whole plants that have any of those genetic changes in every cell of their being. So what we want is to produce thousands and thousands of plants, but each of those plants has a genetic change and it's different to the plant, to its neighbor.
So that gives you your variety. Mm. What's the stress that you apply?
So that was one of the really big scientific questions of what causes differences, and people thought maybe it's high UV, because anecdotally we see higher rates of mutation in New Zealand and we have quite high UV here. We tried temperature shocks and all kinds of things. One of the things we found had the biggest impact was growing grapevine cells in the presence of extracts from yeast from vineyards.
Oh, really?
So the interaction between microorganisms and grapevines seems to change the rate at which their DNA adapts. We don't actually use microorganism extracts anymore because it's very hard to control the dosage, and the microorganisms, if they're not completely removed, they kind of overgrow the grape cells. Hard to get sterile grapevines back from that. But through that, we learned that it's the epigenetics of the DNA that is changing, and so we now use chemicals that mimic that same effect that those microorganisms were having.
Okay, but if you're just changing epigenetics, we spoke last week that they could just change back. Don't you want to change?
That's a really good question. Yeah. So initially, the epigenetics itself is not how we're recovering the diversity, but plants have parts of their DNA that can cause genetic change, called transposons, regions of the DNA that can move around. Colloquially, they've been called jumping genes, parts that can be expressed, reinsert, and cause a mutation. Because they cause these mutations, and most mutations are deleterious, they're generally silenced, highly silenced by methylation. If you remove that methylation, then they can become more active and produce more of the spontaneous genetic diversity.
Well, I don't pretend to understand exactly what methylation means. What I think you're saying is that when you expose it, the DNA sequences just get jumbled up, and normally that's bad, so it doesn't express itself, but you're saying that somehow you're getting it to express itself and stay expressed.
That's right. Actually, we don't even need it to stay expressed. Normally, the plant stops that from happening, because if they had too many mutations, their traits wouldn't be stable. But we just need to give them sort of a few days, 48 hours, for example, of a period during which they are their systems, which stop them from becoming more genetically diverse, are turned off. The interesting thing is, even tissue culture itself is a genetic shock. It causes a stress to the DNA. We don't know if that's because of the fast rate of replication or because of the fact that stem cells, or these totipotent cells, need to have a very low degree of epigenetic methylation, because all genes need to be able to be switched on. But just taking them through tissue culture actually causes a higher rate of genetic mutation than growing plants from cuttings, for example.
Okay, so you've now got these stem cells, or what do you call them,
totipotent, their potency is total. They can become anything.
Yeah, totipotent. Sounds like a tutti frutti ice cream. I got myself some totipotents, yeah. And I'm going to have that with my sour sweets. Okay. So you've got how many of these have you created?
So we've now made 10,000 vines of Sauvignon Blanc, together with our partners, BSI, here in Lincoln. We sort of developed the process, and then they scaled it up for us. They figured out how to apply it to making tens of thousands of plants. And we have a new breeding vineyard, which we've now planted 9,000 of those plants. They go in as tiny little seedlings. We have to recover plants through tissue culture on an agar, on a nutrient medium. They then have to very carefully be deflossed, which is a process of taking them out of the sterile environment, through the nursery. Yeah. It's called hardening off. It's basically toughening them up to be able to withstand an external environment. And then when they are strong enough, we can plant them out in the breeding vineyard.
How many of the cultures, the stem cells, have had their DNA jumbled around so much that they just fail? They're not a viable plant.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's hard to say because they're being jumbled about when they're just blobs of cells. If they're so badly damaged that they can't become a new plant, they probably never grow. So they're kind of removed from the population before we ever recover them. We do, at every subsequent stage, find unusually weak ones that will never survive. We generally try to baby them along a bit because we don't know if that's just, maybe there's a very valuable one that is particularly vulnerable at an early stage. But you're right, there'll be changes that mean that plants never grow back from that cell because of the way that its DNA changed.
And how much change in the DNA is it? Is it still technically a Sauvignon Blanc, a clone of a Sauvignon Blanc?
Yes. So it's what's happened is that the genetics has changed in the exact same way that happens out in a normal vineyard. So of those 10,000, we've done whole genome sequencing of 100 of them so far. They're all genetically unique. That means that they all have changes, but the number of DNA changes, and we've done whole genome sequencing on about 20 commercial clones of Sauvignon Blanc, it's in the same ballpark, about the same number of DNA changes in our clones as there are in the commercial ones. They're the same type of DNA changes. They've basically just gone through something that naturally happens at a very slow rate, but just in one generation.
So you're sitting here now with, what, I'm going to say 9,000 plants out in a test vineyard, growing away. How big are the plants? Are they?
So they've come out over the last 3 years. The most mature plants are, they're over head height. They produced flowers this year. And the smallest ones were planted last week, and they're sort of less than a foot in height and maybe 3 millimeter trunk diameters. They go out at a very juvenile stage, very immature.
Okay. And what's the idea? Because normally when you're doing a clonal selection and you're not using genetics, you would let them grow. And then if you're, say, looking for mold resistance, you'll just leave them alone and see which ones get covered in mold and which ones don't. But I imagine you're doing it a little bit fancier than that, are you?
Or? True. And that's the problem of that type of thing would be a destructive assay. You could do that for mold or frost or anything. You could say, let's let 99.9% of them die and see what survives, but then you can only check one trait because you've eliminated most of your population. And so we're quite conservative in our spray program. We make sure we're applying spray, and then we have to come up with specific assays that can test in quite a high confidence way whether this one plant is more resilient to mildew than another without actually letting mildew into our vineyard, and also in a way that's cheap enough to do on 10,000 vines in one season at approximately the same time of year, because otherwise you start introducing too much environmental and biological variation.
So how do you do that?
So for each trait that our industry has prioritized, we've looked at different tests that we can develop. In the case of powdery mildew resistance, I thought this was going to be something we'd only be able to do much later once we could replicate the trials. But in fact, there was a device developed by the US Department of Agriculture and Cornell that they dubbed the Blackbird, but basically it's a set of optics, it's a microscope on a 3D control platform. And so what we do, we punch a leaf disc from each of the vines.
So you just get a little round disc of leaf.
That's right, about 1 centimeter in diameter. And on these leaf discs, we put them on a tray and we spray them with an inoculum of powdery mildew spores. So a set dosage of powdery mildew spores evenly applied over hundreds and hundreds of leaf discs. And then we grow them for about 10 days. And we use this robot to take photos of each leaf disc. And it takes about a dozen photos of each leaf disc at different heights, combines them into a single image and per leaf disc, and then uses a machine learning, an AI algorithm, to give them a digital score for how much powdery mildew grew on each leaf disc.
Okay, and what sort of variation are you seeing?
We do see quite a bit of variation in the collection so far. I'm hesitant to draw any conclusions until we've really done enough replicative trials that we know that plant X consistently shows less susceptibility, but it's it's a good amount for us. It's really quite promising and gives us a subset of the population to focus on. And that's the key for us right now.
Okay. And is it just molds and mildews you're worried about? If, as we get warmer, we're going to get bud burst earlier and you're going to get more frost events and things like that, possibly. It's one of the risks in the UK anyway.
That's right. So are you looking... more extreme weather events as well. So more likely to have these seasonal frosts.
Are you looking at things like bud burst, veraison, any of those other characteristics?
Absolutely, yeah. So some of the traits that are related to phenology, like timing of bud burst, is a big one for us, because if you can even just push that back a week or two, you reduce your exposure to those spring frosts. We've got a very interesting approach that's being tested that we've done in collaboration with the University of Washington and the University of Canterbury near to us, that looks at the temperature at which the tissue freezes, so differences within the population of sort of susceptibility to freezing. That's another way of getting frost resilience. And then when you talk about ripening, a big challenge for our industry is, in a warming environment, you get sugar ripening coming on earlier. That makes higher alcohol wines because you have to let the fruit hang to develop these flavor compounds and acids. And so for us, looking at the variation between sugar and acid ripening, and looking for plants in the collection that don't have quite as quick sugar accumulation, so you could select for clones that maintain that cool climate style in a warming environment.
And are you still creating more clones at the moment, or have you finished that and now you're in the analysis phase?
Yeah, we've just finished. As of a few weeks ago, we've now finished producing the total number of plants and have planted them out.
You're looking at the traits of the plant, but not necessarily how the final wine tastes.
That's right.
What's the process? Are you doing... because it's no good having a wine that's completely mold resistant, great for frost, but it tastes like rubbish.
Exactly. Yeah. Quality is always primary for our industry. So one of the advantages of clonal diversity is, when one thing changes, it doesn't necessarily impact everything else. If we were breeding, because you're shuffling the genetics at every generation, you get what you want, but you also introduce a whole lot of other changes. The advantage of clonal selection is that most other stuff stays the same. However, you do need to validate that. So we do DNA sequencing so we can actually understand what has changed in the genetics of this plant. And then we've done some trials where we've taken a large collection of the plants. Usually we pull them for wine assessments. At this stage, it's just because we want to validate that the plants we're recovering...
You just want a couple of glasses of wine, mate.
Our research wines are nothing to write home about. But mostly what we just want to know is this still Sauvignon Blanc? Are we sure that on average, although each individual might have a tweak here and there, the thing they have in common is that they're still like the parental clone that we started with. And we've managed to validate that. But you're right, we do need to get to... wow, this plant is promising. What is the quality of the wine like? So we have another project, BSI, or Plant Food Research, that is looking at single vine winemaking. Can we make small ferments and look at the chemistry of those ferments, the volatiles in the headspace, and actually assess them even when we only have a single vine?
The next step is, obviously, if you find a group of plants that have really good disease resistance, will you do genetic testing on that to try and identify the genes that have induced that?
That's the plan. And a big part of that is because we only know the function of a minority of the genes that are in grapevine. The strength of this approach is that we are producing changes that will create traits that we couldn't have made intentionally because we wouldn't have known what to do. But the weakness is it's random. We just have to make a whole lot of changes, which means there's a big cost in plant production and screening these plants. But the advantage of knowing what changed, if we have a change in gene X, which creates a trait improvement that we want, we could, if we wanted to replicate that in Pinot Noir, for example, we could just screen the plants for that trait. And we could use a very cheap genetic technology like PCR to pick the plants of interest. It also allows us, because we collaborate with other international groups, like we just had Kai Vosfels, who leads a breeding program in Geisenheim. They have thousands of reasoning clones. They're also sequencing theirs. So we have these comparative databases where he can say, I've found this interesting trait and this was the change, and I can look in my database and say, do I have a plant that has the same change? It's far cheaper and quicker to import that kind of knowledge than it is to actually ever import the plant material.
We talked last week about cis genetics, where you're taking a gene from another Vitis vinifera, maybe that Riesling plant from Geisenheim, would you consider going, okay, we've got this Pinot Noir, it's got really good traits, but it's missing that one trait. Would you consider cis genetics or to do it, or is that a little bit, it's a little bit dodgy?
As a research tool, I think it's a fantastic idea. Even as a as an application, it's brilliant because it's been validated. It's a really viable approach. The big question is, would anybody want it? In New Zealand, under our current laws, that would still be considered GMO. So I could only do it in a quarantine lab. It could never come out of the lab. And the next question is really, if you had taken some DNA from another variety, would you still be allowed to call that Sauvignon Blanc? And that's kind of an open question at the moment.
Okay. At the end of the project in 2030, what do you hope to have and what's the next steps after that?
Our goal at the end of this project is to have two things. One is the collection of diversity, effectively a repository of genetics for the industry that is a lasting resource, and that has been something that the industry has never had before, specifically in our premium grape variety. But also, we aim to have plants that have been identified because they have improvements in the traits that our industry has prioritized, and we want to have validated those on commercial vineyards. At the moment, taking top grafting buds of the vines in our breeding vineyard onto rootstock in Marlborough, established rootstock in Marlborough, and that seems to be working quite well. But I think within the scope of this program, it's going to be, can we show that we have plants that have improvements? Those improvements are validated in Marlborough, but there will still be multiple seasons needed on multiple sites on commercial scale blocks with winemaking before anyone's going to have the confidence to order a set of cuttings for the next vineyard of that.
Exactly. And it was to nurseries, really, isn't it? They're the ones who...
Exactly, yeah. So we have nurseries who are granters on the program, who are part of the program and who are doing those grafting trials for us. And you're right, they're the next user in the program.
All right then, I think we'll wrap it up there, Daryl. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Have I missed anything there?